Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is a very articulate man, Blair Horner, Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. He's back again. Welcome, Blair.
Thanks for having me, Alan. Great to talk to you.
Well, we always love to have you because our listeners love your incredible insight into what's going on. So let's talk about the holiday surprise, a pay raise for lawmakers. You say in your column, Governor Hochul says she supports the pay raise. What do you say, Blair?
Well, I mean, it's a long question. A long answer to that. It's a very simple question. I mean, just as a backdrop, there was a commission that was created a few years ago that allowed for pay increases for the legislature for up to $130,000, which would make them the highest paid in the country. The commission was the people who made that determination, of course, were directly appointed by the governor and the legislative leaders, and so they are not, in our view, an independent body. Nevertheless, they made that decision, and they linked that pay raise to limits on outside income and a reduction in the number of available so-called LULUs, which is stipends that each of the committee chairs get. It was challenged in court, so they got their first pay raise up to $110,000. It was the first time they had a pay raise in about 20 years. But the next two phases, to increase it up to 130, were stopped due to the court case. And it also stopped the limit on outside income and the LULU ban. So the court ruled last month that they could go ahead with that. And so now there's all this noise and activity that lawmakers will return next week to have a special holiday bash increase their salaries and may link it to limits on outside income. So I don't know if $130,000 is the right number, because that will make them the highest paid in the country. But I think the New Yorkers should want an independent review of what the compensation should be, and it should go up or down depending on what the determination is. I don't know if they deserve to be the highest paid in the country, but they will be if the rumors turn out to be true.
So let me ask you this, Blair Horner. Who is against this pay raise?
Well, the Republicans seem to be making a lot of noise about it, although my guess is they probably secretly like it. Taxpayers are not thrilled. The reason that they do these pay raises, if it happens, in December is because it happens to be right after the election, and so New Yorkers get 2 years to cool off. And if they do it in December, it can be effective as of January. December of an even-numbered year, it can be effective that following January of the odd-numbered year. So it's effectively giving themselves a pay raise for next month. So the people that don't typically like it are the taxpayers, and there have been noises from the Republicans about these rumors.
Now, the governor, Governor Hochul, says she supports the pay raise. What do you make of that?
Well, it opens the door that gives them cover. She's the highest paid governor in the country. And so maybe she thinks that the legislature should be the highest paid in the country, too. And her argument, you know, and the public argument was, well, you know, they work so hard and all that kind of stuff. Again, there's no way, in my opinion, that anyone can know what the right pay should be. But they are talking about bumping their salaries up to $130,000 a year. That's pretty good money. And the governor's, you know, saying that she supports it, basically opens the door to a holiday party.
Now, what's the role of the New York Public Interest Research Group in all of this, or NYPIRG?
Well, we have long argued that lawmakers shouldn't have outside jobs. And the reason is that, you know, when you're a legislator, you're supposed to be looking out first and foremost for the public that's elected you to office. And if you have an outside job, that can create conflicts of interest. You're making money on the outside. You know, maybe the interests of wherever you're making the money run counter to the interests of the public. In Congress, there is a limit on outside income. So lawmakers shouldn't be in the position of serving two masters. We believe that they should serve one master, and that's the people that vote them in. Congress has a limit on outside income for the exact same reason. And we think that that should be done no matter what happens. So our role will be to advocate for reforms that we think are appropriate in terms of limits on outside income. And we think there should be established a compensation commission that is independent of the governor and the legislature to make, you know, reasonable adjustments over time that could go up or down.
Blair, public health is an issue. You deal with it, NYPIRG. So what do you make of the New York City Mayor Eric Adams' new initiative that would allow authorities to more aggressively intervene to help people in need of mental health treatment? The Democratic directive would give outreach workers, city hospitals, also the police, the legal authority to involuntarily hospitalize anyone they deem a danger to themselves or is unable to care for themselves, even if they're not a danger to others. Are you surprised that a Democrat came up with this?
Well, not really. The grumbling that you hear from New Yorkers is in one of the areas of public safety. And the issue of, you know, what happens to people who are homeless is a big issue. The governor's talked about that she wants to unveil, in fact, a big housing initiative to sort of expand the availability of housing, particularly for people who need it. And a lot of the people that are homeless have mental health issues. So the tension, though, is between the civil liberties side of the equation, which is, you know, the government stepping in to involuntarily take somebody off the street and put them in a hospital. And then, of course, the public health side of it, which is if people are in distress, someone should look out for them. And, you know, the devil's in the details on how you put that kind of stuff together, like what happens to the people when they end up in the hospital, who pays for it, what kind of services are the people getting? Because, again, the fundamental problem for the vast majority of people that are homeless is in fact the problem of housing and inability of individuals to afford a decent place to live. And that really, it's called homelessness for a reason, and that really stems from the problem. So what the mayor is talking about, you know, obviously can be very helpful for people that are in real distress, but the fundamental policy problem, hopefully the governor will have something to offer next month.
What would you like to see him offer?
Well, the governor, I don't know what her plan is in terms of housing. She's talked about it as a top priority for her State of the State address. We're not engaged. I mean, our organization is not a housing advocacy group, but it seems just as somebody who, you know, pays attention that the state is going to need to do something to give people that need housing. New York City has essentially the equivalent of like the city of Binghamton in terms of homelessness. And, you know, that's a big problem and it's going to take a big solution.
And so when we explore those solutions, we always come up with the word money, don't we? And the question of who's going to be asked to put that up?
Yeah, I mean, and the state's finances erode over time if you look ahead because the federal support through the various COVID programs that the federal government's unveiled, that money dries up toward the end of this calendar year, this upcoming calendar year. And so, you know, where the money's going to come from is going to be the big question. And it's not only housing that's a problem and homelessness. Funding for higher education, funding for K-12 education, all of the other programs that are necessary, and health insurance for people that don't have it. I mean, you put all of that stuff together, and there's going to be cost. I mean, our view, would be that we'd like to see the oil companies picking up at least the environmental costs of the state, because after all, they created the mess that we're all living through, and they have the money. So there's one industry that I think the state could tap, and if done correctly, the cost would not be passed on to consumers.
Who does that? I mean, who actually tells them you got to do this? Who is the instrument of their potential destruction?
Well, I don't know if it's destruction that I'm talking about, but certainly the business model has to be wound down.
Yeah.
Right now, the oil companies are doing everything they can to block science and environmental programs, and they want to keep drilling, and they want to keep building out new fossil fuel infrastructure everywhere because they want to keep in business. That business model is destroying the planet. They have to be wound down. The way you could create it, in New York, would be to design a program that essentially assesses them in the same way as the current state superfund assesses polluters. So, for example, some company responsible for dumping PFOS into the drinking water of some community, and let's say in the Capital District, they're on the hook to pay for the cleanup. There should be something similar to that when it comes to the climate, because after all, the reason that we're in this catastrophe that we're in is because for decades, the oil companies have known this is going to be a problem. And they, instead of telling everybody, they spent millions of dollars to undermine the science, bamboozle the public, and make campaign contributions to their favorite legislative toadies to stop efforts to deal with it. And so here we are, in the year 2022, with a rapidly heating planet, wildfires everywhere, rising sea levels. That's going to cost money.
Yes, and always the question comes back to who's got the money and who will give it to the public authorities in order to spend it. In the past, that's not been an easy question to answer, has it?
No, because the people with the money fight tooth and nail not to fork it over. And so the cost gets shifted to the public. And so, our view is, if you look at the you look at the profits the oil companies are making, they should be the ones. I mean, last quarter, the third quarter of this calendar year, Aramco, the Saudi oil company, made $42 billion, billion in profits. Exxon made almost $20 billion last quarter in profits, not revenues, profits. And so why not use that money to offset the sticker shock cost to New Yorkers to have to pay for elevated roadways, new culverts, and MTA in New York City that is sealed off from floods, and other ways to deal with rising sea levels that are going to affect Long Island, New York City, and its suburbs. But just to give you another sticker number, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers last month came out with a report and said to protect New York Harbor alone is $52 billion. So where is that money going to come from? We think the other guys should pay for it.
Wow. Now let's go to higher ed. I know that NYPIRG has been for the power for students to vote on campus. How's that coming?
Well, it's very interesting. A new law went into effect this year that put polling places on college campuses if they had 300 registered voters or more. So that new law went into effect. There was a big fight down in Dutchess County where the Republican Elections Commissioner just refused to follow the law. And so, as far as I could tell, suffered no consequences. But eventually there was a polling place put on Vassar, for example. That was one where there was a fight. I mean, the turnout, we haven't seen the election district turnouts on these college campuses. But, the turnout across the state wasn't great. It was well below the national average. And it was by age group. I mean, it was, a paltry turnout, which, by the way, I think contributed to the governor's more narrow victory than I think people expected. So I think the state needs to look carefully at how it deals, particularly with college students and registering to vote. So if there are some colleges, for example, that just tell the students they have to register from wherever their parents live, and that's not right. I mean, it's up to the student to decide where their domicile is, just like it is for a senior who may have a place down in Florida and a place in New York. It's where you spend most of your time. And the college students, for example, if they live on a college campus, they're there 8 months out of the year. They're counted in the census as living there. They pay taxes there, sales taxes. If that's how they view where their life is, they should be allowed, they should be encouraged to register to vote there. And that doesn't always work. So I think, you know, the importance of getting 18 to 24-year-olds, again, college students are not just 18 to 24, but the younger voters, to get them to develop the muscle memory to vote and participate in civic life starts early. And the state should do everything it can to make it easy for them to register and to vote. I think there needs to be more that needs to be done there, because the turnout, it looks like anyway, was pretty low.
As long as we're on college campuses, let's talk about that. So why are college campuses facing such financial distress? For example, the spring semester will be the last for students and faculty at Cassanova College in New York. The college cited financial concerns in its closure. What gives? Is this something we can expect more of?
Yeah, I think so. Unfortunately, both in the independent and public sectors. In the independent side, the private colleges, in the universities, the NYUs, the Columbias of the world, as far as I can tell, are in reasonable,
okay,
in good shape financially. Yeah. Yeah, they have gigantic endowments. They're viewed as an international, global sort of place to go. But the little ones, the little privates, they don't have the same endowments, and they rely on enrollment to sort of make it financially.
Right.
Same thing with the same thing on the public side. The university centers are in reasonably good shape financially, but the four-year publics and the colleges and the community colleges are in terrible shape, by and large. And so the state has to do more. I mean, these colleges are all many little economic engines that, you know, churn along, and every dollar you put into them, you get back multiples in terms of economic activity and jobs and everything else. The state spends billions of dollars on economic development. They should spend money on higher education, because that is an economic engine that actually works. So we'll see. I mean, you know, the financial stuff is bad. Partly it's demographic. And the 18 to 24-year-old population is shrinking in New York. But there's still plenty of 18 to 24-year-olds who don't go to college. And the state should be doing more to encourage them to do so. The state's tuition assistance program turns 50 soon, and that would be that anniversary would be a good time for the state to sort of reevaluate what the college students need to go to college, because it's in the state's economic and civic interest to have a well-educated populace.
Well, who opposes that? I mean, I get it, and I think you're right. Of course, I was a college teacher for all of those years. But who opposes? Who says that we shouldn't be supporting higher education to the degree you'd like?
Well, no one says it, but effectively that's what happens in budgets. I mean, it's not like colleges have any sort of leverage when they can't say, you know, Cassanova can't come to the legislature and say, well, you know, if you don't give us the support we need, we're going to move our college to another state. And so there's no, in the game of, you know, the night of the long knives, when they're doing the budgets, colleges have to play a weaker political hand, because they just simply don't have the normal leverage. And so, you know, it's, you know, in terms of where your priorities are, and there's not, again, and as a percentage of the population, it's not a huge percentage of the population that's affected. And so it ends up, you know, on the cutting room floor, effectively. And what you've seen over the past few decades, in particular, particularly the last 10 years, it's been a substantial pullback in state support for higher education, other than raising tuition on the public side and reducing financial aid on the independent side. And that formula leads you to where we are today. And it's going to, you know, to reverse that downward cycle, is going to take state investments and smart strategies to get students to go back to college, to participate in college. I mean, the state's Excelsior program, for example, is a good idea. Try to figure out a way to make it easier for more middle-income students to go to college. It's a good idea. But it's, you know, it's created in such a way that very few students can participate in it. Why not expand the tuition assistance program to make it so that all of those students just get, as a matter of course, financial aid to go to college? I think more students would go if they could do that.
Let's go to ethics reform. One of my favorites in state government, the comptroller Tom DiNapoli, wants Governor Hochul to give him his pre-audit powers back. Remember when they took that away? Of course you do, because we've discussed it. But she hasn't signed the bill yet. What's the latest?
Yeah, well, the bill hasn't gone to her desk yet, and so the clock hasn't started ticking. Just so that everybody, the listeners
sure.
know, roughly 1,000 bills passed in the legislative session this year. Roughly two-thirds of them have been acted upon by the governor. Roughly 170 or 180 are on her desk now that were delivered in the past few days. And then there's roughly 85 that have not yet gone to the governor's desk. And those last ones often are the most controversial. And so maybe the governor's trying to negotiate changes to the bill at the last minute, or maybe she's going to wait to veto it right before Christmas. So, you know, in that particular case, there's a tension between a governor and a comptroller, both separately elected statewide officials. That tension's always been there because mm-hmm. the comptroller is supposed to be the person monitoring the books, and the governor doesn't want that. So former Governor Cuomo, cut back the comptroller's powers. There's been scandals during the time about government contracts. And so we certainly agree that the comptroller should have his audit powers back, and we have urged the governor to sign the bill, but we don't know what they're going to do yet. Partly there is this institutional tension, and partly there may be sort of technical changes that the governor's office would like to see, but we don't know which way the governor's going to go yet.
But you are saying that DiNapoli is right, that he wants those pre-audit powers back, and we've been following this for quite a while. And so the question is, will we do the right thing here?
Yeah, well, hope springs eternal, the three words that I live by. Hopefully the governor, signs off on the bill again. There may be some technical side of this thing that's being discussed, but it certainly makes no sense to us for the comptroller to have his powers pulled back, particularly after during the last 10 years, there have been monumental scandals in terms of government contracting in the areas that the comptroller used to audit. And people behave differently if they know they're watching.
Sure.
It raises the corruption risk in New York to have weaker powers for the comptroller.
The latest poll from Siena College shows that New York Governor Kathy Hochul is not in a particularly strong position with voters about a month after winning election to a full term. How come?
Yeah, that's a good question. The polling that came out sort of matched what she got in terms of a vote in November. And, the governor, who was widely expected to sort of be on cruise control to victory, had a much, much, much tougher election bid than I think people expected. And her opponent, current representative, soon to be former representative, Lee Zeldin, ran a much better campaign than I think people expected and had a lot more financial support than anyone expected. And so I think partly it's that, partly, coming out of a bruising election where somebody's hammering away on your record. I mean, that obviously has to have some sort of, echo even a month out. So I think partly it's that. Partly that the governor is, sort of the new kid on the block. I mean, she's been the lieutenant governor for 7 years. She's been governor for the past year. But I don't think she's really made her mark yet in terms of what it is that she wants to do. She was really sort of running on the with the Cuomo administration team agenda for the past year and running for election, raising campaign contributions, et cetera. So I think we'll get to see who the real Kathy Hochul is pretty soon. It may be the same person that was last year, but this is a chance for her. She's got a full four-year term to sort of imprint her views on the state of New York, obviously with the legislature. So I think that it's partly that. It's partly that she's, doesn't have the same sort of base. There's like the Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo had this sort of his dad's sort of political base, name recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy Hochul has to make her name yet. We'll see how it goes. But I'm not surprised that the polling looks like the election results, because there was a lot of money being spent pounding away on her, and that's going to have an impact for, weeks to come.
Blair Horner, you have been very interested in the environment, you and Nyberg. So Nyberg is now hiring students, recent grads, and other passionate, motivated activists to work with our community outreach programs in the urgent fight against the climate crisis. Tell us more.
Well, we were when we were talking earlier about making the oil companies pay for the costs of climate change because it's their responsibility because they made the mess, they should clean it up, the basic thing that we all learn when we're in kindergarten. I mean, you know, the way, but they're going to spend a lot of money to block that legislation. And, you know, and the way that you really can take on the big money is through sort of organized people. And so it's important to build sort of grassroots support for various initiatives, whatever they are, certainly in the area of the environment. And you saw that play out on the campaign years ago. It was about 10 years ago now, to ban fracking in New York State. It was really organized money versus organized people. The more recent fight over requiring that cryptocurrency mining operations, quote unquote, be done in a pause button on the particular type of it that uses a lot of power to make it work. And so there are ways, you know, you take on the crypto industry, there was a lot of money in that a few months ago, there isn't anymore. And 10 years ago was really, you know, it was Exxon that was trying to get access to the state's gas reserves that they would get through fracking. So, that's what you have to do. And we do, you know, we devise all different kinds of ways as we can to try to get people engaged so that they can have an impact on public policy in a way that we think helps protect the environment.
Blair Horner, we love having you with us. You know more about state politics and about our politics than anybody else I know, and we thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org or just schedule a podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. Thanks for listening.